You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SevillePodcast.com. Don't miss another great podcast. Sign up for our email alerts today. I'm Dan Gould. The Congressional Candidates Showcase Forum is a biannual event sponsored by the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. This year, only one candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives, Democratic challenger General John Douglas, spoke at the event. Incumbent Congressman Robert Hurt declined the Senior Statesman invitation to attend the forum. This is only the second time since 1996 that a candidate has failed to attend. Mr. Hurt also declined in 2010. The candidate spoke at the Wednesday, August 8, 2012 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by local radio personality and historian Coy Barefoot.
I'm Coy Barefoot, and as Sue said, among other things that I do, I host and produce Charlottesville Right Now, which we are in our seventh year. Every afternoon on WINA, start at 4 o'clock, so that's where I'm heading when we finish here. I'm going to go over there and talk about the latest on UVA and who's resigning and all that fun stuff we like to talk about. And it is a real privilege, and that's how I think about this. This is a privilege for me to get to participate in any of the forums sponsored by the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. They have a long tradition here of sponsoring these events that help inform voters, not only inform voters, but help citizens meet those who would represent them. And that's really how I think about it. It's not just getting informed, because you can go online and get informed, you can read things and get informed, but this is an opportunity for you to actually sit and talk to face-to-face those who step forward and seek your support for elected office. And sadly, these days, that is an increasingly rare event. Would that it were not. Today we have an opportunity to meet and to talk with General John Douglas, who is the Democratic nominee for Congress, and we are glad you are here.
Thank you.
Robert Hurt declined to participate in this event. According to his campaign, his schedule would not permit it. Both campaigns were invited in March, as it is a long-standing tradition that the Senior Statesman of Virginia sponsors the first public debate and forum for the 5th District. This is nothing new. And I will speak for all of us when I say we're disappointed that Congressman Hurt could not be here today, but we are very happy that we have this opportunity to get to know General John Douglas and hear from him. So here's how it's going to work. You write the questions down and just hold them up, and somebody will find you, and we'll bring them up here, and then I will read them on the microphone so we can all hear it. And we'll give General Douglas an opportunity to respond with whatever time he needs. And I believe we have an hour and a half. Is that right, Jim? We've got an hour and a half. So we've got plenty of time to cover all the bases, A to Z, anything you are thinking about. This is a congressional office now, so this is not just local issues, but these are national and international issues as well that we want to discuss today. And I want to thank each one of you for being here and participating in this event. Thank you. I'm going to get us started just by, again, thanking you for being here. And I would like to have you respond to the fact that you are sitting by yourself. And I did not find out that this was not going to include both candidates until literally just a few days ago. That may be your case as well. Get us up to speed now about where we might see both of you together and have that opportunity to hear you debate and discuss issues together publicly. And I know that you have invited Congressman Hurt to participate in a number of events. General Douglas.
Well, thank you, Coy. Let me begin by also thanking all of you for being here. This is grassroots democracy at its best. As many of you know, I spent the bulk of my life as a soldier. I've served all over the world under our starry flag, and I still get goosebumps when I hear the Star Spangled Banner and I see that flag go up. And all those years of serving our country were to give us the freedom to do meetings like this, to ask any question that you want, to find out where your candidates stand on every issue that you can imagine. So it's really, really important for you all to be here. I'm sorry that my opponent is not here. I think there is nothing more important than the contrast that comes when both of us are on the stage together. There's very, very clear choice when you see the two of us and you look at our records. Mine is one of many years of service in the United States Air Force. I retired as a brigadier general. Went on to serve on the staff of the Senate Armed Services Committee for Senator Sam Nunn from Georgia, was the chairman in those days. President Clinton appointed me to be Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Research, Development, and Acquisition, which is one of the most powerful positions in the Pentagon. And for about 5 years, I bought everything that the United States Navy and the Marine Corps bought, from research all the way to the ships and tanks and airplanes that we deployed. And so I've worked also in bipartisan situations. I was spent 5 years in the Reagan White House as Director of Defense Programs on the National Security Council, had personal access to the President on a weekly basis. So I know what it's like to work on administrations on both sides of the aisle. And I just think that Congressman Hurt doesn't want to be up on the stage with me because the choices are relatively clear. On the one side, you have a career politician. On the other side, you have someone who's served our country in a number of jobs. I was poor when I was young. Some of you know that. My family became bankrupt when I was a teenager, and I was homeless for a while, lived in my car for a couple of months, didn't know where the next meal was going to come from. I've often told people the story of how much I hated beets until I went 2 or 3 days without eating anything, and I got invited to somebody's house, and they had beets, and that was one of the most delicious meals I ever ate. You know, I had an opportunity to work my way through high school and college, and took ROTC and served those years in the Air Force. I retired as the number two general over at NATO headquarters in Belgium. Many of you will remember that I was the American general that the terrorists kept trying to kidnap. They almost got me a couple of times, but by the grace of the Lord, we survived that. So the choices are clear, and I'm just sorry that whatever Congressman Hurt's priorities are, that he didn't place your priorities to hear us together and to allow us to debate above whatever it is he's doing today. And I think that's a shame that he is ducking the opportunity for us to have the kind of civil discussions that will come from your questions today. So I hope you all put in some good questions, and I'll be glad to answer them with my heart open to you in the most straightforward way that I can.
Start us off by telling us why serving in Congress is the next step for your career. Tell us about the general view of the campaign, why you're running, and
That's a great question, Coy. You know, I didn't wake up one morning and say, gee, I think I'll run for Congress today. you know, I'm retired from my last position. I was president and CEO of a big trade organization in Washington. And back during the last election, I was asked by Mrs. Clinton to help her with her campaign. She wanted me to introduce her to veterans all over the country. And I knew Bill and Hillary from my days as Assistant Secretary of the Navy. In fact, she was the sponsor of one of my nuclear submarines that I bought, the USS Columbia. And she did a terrific job in that. You know, the sponsor is not only the one that breaks the champagne over the bow, but then you have to take care of the crew after that, you know. So if, you know, one of them has to go home on emergency leave, the sponsor is the one that organizes some way to get some money so that can happen and so on. And I saw the mother side of her in many ways. And so I helped her for up until she dropped out of the race, and she asked me to then go support President Obama. And I did that, campaigned all over the country for him. So this past year, they contacted me and said, we want a general officer from Virginia who's a farmer to run for Congress. And I went, you mean me? and they called me in, and I said, well, you know, I have to talk to my family about this, and we have to pray on it a little bit. And we did that. And Susan and I finally agreed that our country needs leadership right now. And I've had the opportunity to be a leader for our country. We need people who can work across party lines, who will go to Washington and put the interests of the people of the 5th District first, party politics second, and make sure that our interests are protected. And they know who I am. I've testified before Congress hundreds of times. You can go to the Reagan Library and Google me, and you can see all the things that I wrote for President Reagan during his tenure as president, and when we brought down the Soviet Union and we ended the Cold War. So there's a large body of public information about who I am. And so I'm not one of those politicians that's going to reinvent myself for this task. I am what I am, and my answers to you today will be from my heart about what I am and how I feel. And the bottom line was, when asked one more time, they actually put it to me this way. They said, General, we're calling you back to active duty one more time. We need you to serve. And I just couldn't say no. I love this country too much to say no.
Let me ask you about just a few days ago, we witnessed truly something so amazing. And as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't get much red, white, and blue, more red, white, and blue than this, to see the ingenuity and the skill, the creativity of some American scientists and engineers at NASA. And they were able to send what amounts to a small car 352 million miles through space, drop it 18,000 miles an hour through the Martian atmosphere, and land perfectly, safely, and intact on the surface of Mars. That project budget is about $2.6 billion. We spend that same amount every week in Iraq and Afghanistan, right? Not in this country. What are your thoughts, general thoughts, and be specific, please, and general, about those are the kind of answers I like. About this idea, and there's a lot in there, I know. There's funding for NASA, which is being cut at the same time that we're seeing some amazing science and discovery. There is the spending now that's estimated to be, what, about 60 cents out of every dollar we spend as Americans goes towards the military engine and those serving overseas, and money spent in places like Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, Coy, that's a great question. And I am, as many of you know, I am in favor of bringing our troops home from Afghanistan as soon as we can safely withdraw them. We are spending 300 and some million dollars a day. You multiply that by seven, that's where you get Coy's figure of $2 billion a week. We could have paid for that whole NASA thing in 1 week of Afghanistan. But just think what we could do here in the 5th District, folks, if we had just 1 week of that Afghanistan money. The extra pay that we could get for our teachers who are working their hearts out to educate our children. The bridges and roads that we could repair. The things that we could do to help grow jobs, particularly down in the southern part of the district, where unemployment down there in some of our counties is above 20%. The programs that we could have for our children, sports programs to help them stay out of trouble and combat teenage obesity and so on. There are just tons and tons of things that we could do. And we do have to cut the defense budget. There is no question about it. We've got to reduce the deficit, and all of the parts of our government have got to pay a share in that. But we've also got to increase revenue, Coy. And it's going to be a balanced program that is worked out by both sides of the aisle that's going to help us get out of this. And those politicians at Washington that say, no, it has to be my side of the thing and nothing from the other side, are hurting this country. And that's why we need to elect people like myself that know how to work across the aisle, know how to compromise, have served in administrations on both sides of the aisle, and know what America's priorities ought to be.
How do you reduce military spending when you get into Washington and you find the number of lobbyists for these the companies, and they're well entrenched in Washington? How do you actually go about doing that?
Well, the way you do it is you have to develop a national security strategy which works for the country. You know, folks, we still are using the same basic national security strategy that we had back during the Cold War. And it doesn't work very good against terrorism. So we need a new strategy. And I've been a proponent of a strategy which I believe is that we need to take some of our military investments and move them from investing in offensive things, these are things that go and bomb other places and so on, to what I call defensive things. I think it's really getting more and more important that we know what's coming across our borders. Who and what is coming across our borders? What is coming through our ports? And what is coming across our coastlines? When I was your Assistant Secretary of the Navy, I developed very, very highly classified programs to keep track of Soviet submarines. And I used to go out with my sailors on those missions when we would be trying to detect the quietest of the Russian submarines. And every now and then we'd get a hit on a submarine and we'd run it through our computers. And we'd very quickly find out it wasn't a Russian, it wasn't British, it wasn't French. And we'd go through all the countries we knew had computers. And guess what we would discover it was? It was a drug submarine. And so we'd call the Coast Guard and tell the Coast Guard, you need to come out here and drop some sonobuoys and get these guys. And pretty soon, wop, 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 out they'd come, and you could hear them get excited on the radio. And they'd drop their sonobuoys, and they'd say, yeah, yeah, they're right, we got one, we got one. And then they'd call us up on the radio and say, who are you guys up there? And we'd say, if we told you, we'd have to shoot you down. But we can use those technologies to help secure our borders and our ports and our coastlines. And we could do it at a lot less money than what we're spending in these overseas wars and without a lot of people getting killed. And the money would all be invested here at home.
We have a number of questions here regarding health care. So let me see if I can pull them together in a not-so-complicated question. We have somebody who's asked about, a couple of people who've asked about Medicare, your thoughts on Medicare. We have a couple of people who've asked about the recent Supreme Court's decision regarding Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act, and its implementation in Virginia, which thus far the governor, Governor McDonnell, has said that he would not support.
Well, you know, let me just start this by asking some of you to raise your hands on something. How many of you are veterans who served with me? Okay. You all know, you remember when we went through basic training, one of the things that you learn about your comrades is we get into combat, we're not going to leave each other on the battlefield. Soldiers don't leave their wounded on the battlefield. And us military people, that's one of the most basic principles that we learn as young soldiers. And it really pains me when I see these politicians who are willing to rip our health care right out from under our senior citizens who've worked their lives to earn it and say, here, we're going to give you this flim-flam voucher here system, which is what's embedded in the Ryan budget. And you go find an insurance company that'll meet your needs. And by the way, at the same time as they were doing that, they were going around behind our back at the Supreme Court trying to kill the parts of the Affordable Health Care program that prohibit those insurance companies from denying us insurance if we have a preconceived, condition. So, you know, the other side of the aisle's approach to medical care for seniors is shameful. It's shameful. And I don't understand how they go to church on Sunday or how they look in the mirror and advocate what they've advocated for in the Ryan budget. And so, you know, they try to wrap it in some kind of fiscal responsibility, but then at the same time, they vote against President's jobs programs. They vote against education, things that are going to actually begin to grow our economy. And I will just tell you that protecting health care for seniors is one of the most important things that I will do when I'm there in Congress. I'm going to also make sure that our veterans who desperately need health care, that are coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan with these terrible wounds. You know, I was at Bethesda Naval Hospital the other day. Both my wife and my son needed to go. They both needed to get their eyes dilated, and my son needed to get a football physical. So guess who got to be the driver, you know, and because neither one of them could drive. So, you know, while I was there, we had to go from one building to another, and there was a young African-American soldier walking down the sidewalk. He had both legs blown off, and he was wearing his new artificial legs, and he was moving quite slowly with two canes, very deliberately from one building to another with his backpack on. And I walk by, I still get a little emotional when I think about this. I looked at that young man, fine-looking young man, and I thought to myself, now here's a young man that has put his whole future on the line for us, and now he's home, and we're taking care of him in the Navy. But when he leaves the Navy, he's going to go and be taken care of by the Veterans Administration. And the Ryan budget, which my opponent supports, decimates funding for veterans in the Veterans Administration. We already have a backlog of months and months. Some of these kids, when they come out of combat and they're put out onto civilian life, have to wait as much as 8 or 9 months before they get their first disability checks. So we need to do more for veterans, and we need to make sure that we protect the health care of our seniors. Those are two fundamental things that I will be a fierce defender of, folks.
So you would support then the implementation of the Affordable Health Care Act, Obamacare, in
yes.
Virginia, the creation
yes.
of the state exchanges and
absolutely.
The increase of Medicare funding, Medicaid
yes.
funding?
Yes.
Okay. We have a question, let me see, regarding Citizens United. 40 senators have met as a result of a grassroots movement to overturn that Supreme Court decision, which gave legal personhood to corporations and entitled them to the rights with which most individuals have had as a result of the Bill of Rights. Free speech is one. Your thoughts on Citizens United?
I thought that Supreme Court decision on Citizens United was a terrible mistake, and I will join with other members of Congress to overturn it. I think these super PACs were people on the fringe of our political systems on either side of the aisle with millions and billions of dollars. Just think, if you have so much money that you can give $100 or $200 or $300 million to one of these super PACs, what you are doing is and don't be misled by this, folks. Don't be misled at all. They're saying to you and to me, you common folks vote don't count. You don't count. We're going to buy this election. And I think that's wrong. I think if our founding fathers could look down on that Supreme Court decision, they would recoil in horror. This was to be a country for the people, by the people. And so you can count on me to do everything I can to put these super PACs out of business. In fact, I think the money part of politics is the very root of most of our problems today. That's where the polarization comes from. And that's where we get so many members of Congress who don't know what the heck's even in the bills they vote for. Why? Because they're spending all of their time catering to those people that gave them the money to get elected, or they're calling on the phone asking for more money. And when I was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, I used to work from, 7 in the morning till 9 or 10 at night just to get my mind around the problems that little it's not a little part, but it's a huge part of our defense program, hundreds of billions of dollars a year. But it you know, it was an enormous task to really understand it and manage it and do the right things. And just think, if you're a congressman, you know, you oversee vast parts of our economy, vast parts of our national security, and you have the very future of our people in your hands. And so are you reading the bills? Are you spending time learning about the facts? No, you're on the phone with money. And I think it's the root of most of our problems. So you could count on me to be a fierce supporter of efforts to overturn that.
Just a reminder.
By the way, let me just add, that's why Mr. Hurt's not here today. He's out there getting more money from the people that bought and sold him here today. So,
just a reminder, if you've joined us late, we want to hear from you. So write your question down and just raise it up, and somebody will come get it for you and bring it up here to me. Tell us about how you would have voted. I have a question here regarding, if you were in Congress at the time, how would you have voted on the stimulus bill? And there was also the Troubled Asset Relief Program called TARP. Your thoughts on that? It was right at the transition between President Bush and President Obama.
Monday morning quarterback thing. Yeah. But, you know, clearly our economy was collapsing, and we had to do something to stimulate it. And I think the idea of us investing money to get the economy moving again was basically an attempt at, you know, classic economic theory that you had to inject money into the economy to get it rolling again. I think if there is a problem with it, in some areas the administration of it got off the track a little bit. You know, I've heard of some examples of where the money wasn't used as effectively maybe as it could have been. But that goes back to what I was talking about before, and that is that many members of Congress are not exercising their legitimate oversight duties. They're out there chasing the money all the time. And so, you know, we badly need campaign finance reform, and we need members of Congress who are dedicated to understanding what are the things that need to be done in their district, but also what are things that need to be done in the national scale, and will stand up to their responsibilities. But, you know, from what I've read and what I've heard, and I'm not an economist, I'm a soldier and a businessman and a farmer, but, you know, our economy was on the verge of absolute collapse. And some of the money went to good things like, you know, we were able to save the automobile industry in the United States. And by the way, folks, I don't know if you know this or not, but the automobile industry in the United States and our military are very closely related. The same people that build automobiles build our trucks and tanks and things for our military. And had the automobile industry gone under, the price for our weapons for our kids in Iraq and Afghanistan would have gone through the roof. And, you know, this was a very complex problem that the president faced.
You mentioned campaign finance reform. The last campaign finance reform gave us the super PACs that we have today. So I guess you wouldn't have supported that version of
no. Campaign finance reform that I have in mind is, and I'll just give you a brief overview of what I think we ought to do in the House. I think for the first year after you're elected, you should not be able to take money from anybody, and you should not be able to put any of your own money into the campaign. For the first year in office, you have to concentrate 100% on doing your job as a congressman. For the second year, when you're getting ready to run again, in the first 6 months of that second year, I would hold campaign contributions down to a very small level. And then in the last 6 months before the election, I would like to see House races given a certain amount of federal money, which would come from that dollar that you put in on your income tax, and everybody get the same amount so that we could, as closely as we could, take money out of the equation. So that we're electing our members of Congress based on their qualifications and their abilities to get the job done. Because right now, it unfortunately often devolves down to who can get out there and make the most promises to these corporations and PACs and get the most money and buy the most TV ads and then win. And that's not the way our founding fathers envisioned this democracy should work.
Would Would reform in that regard also include term limits? Because I would imagine that might be part of the same package.
I don't see any reason why members of the House should serve longer than a president. That's, you know, presidents are limited to 8 years. You know, I'd be willing to step up to that.
We were talking about the economy and have some questions regarding regarding the situation with which we're now faced as a nation. And I want to hear more thoughts on that that you might have about the economy. But let's start with the fact that I guess it's no secret that, you know, many American corporations are sitting on literally trillions of dollars that they're not invested,
right,
that they're holding back for a variety of reasons, one of which I guess that we read about quite a bit is the uncertainty in the marketplace, the uncertainty in the economy, that they're afraid to make a move, they're afraid to put their money in a certain place because there's a lot of unknowns today, and they might be more inclined to put them in some foreign growth markets versus here and investing in the American people. How do we get them off the dime and start investing here and creating jobs in America? Is there a place for Congress? Is there a place for the government in that endeavor?
Well, Coy, that's a very complex question, and I do think there is a role for Congress in the sense that I think much of the uncertainty that you talked about stems from the fact that Congress is so polarized today. And I think it's time for members of the Congress on both sides of the aisle to start putting the American people first and the politics of their parties second, and to get this economy moving. And if they would do things like pass the bills on time, wouldn't that be a good idea? Stop squibbling and squabbling and threatening each other over debt ceiling dates and things of that nature, which we all know are designed to get a headline. And they all know that, you know, when some of these artificial deadlines come up, they have to, at the end, move the deadline to another time or something. They know they have to appropriate the next year's budget. But they squabble and fight right down to the deadline, and that's what creates that uncertainty. And so I think the leaders in Congress on both sides of the aisle share some of that blame. And but it's also leadership from the White House, and it's leadership in industry. The captains of industry have got to step up and start doing the right thing for America and stop investing our money overseas. You know, the Republicans always talk about trickle down, but they don't trickle it down to the 5th District. They trickle it down to China. And we need to make incentives so that it's not in their best interest to do that. You know, why did the furniture production in Southside go offshore? Why did the textile mills go offshore? It we ought to create incentives so that doesn't happen. But the uncertainty, I think, Coy, comes largely from the political squabbling in Washington that is so annoying to us all and to business.
So we have a number of questions, in fact. A lot. I think most of this audience, just by the gauge here of what's in front of me, a lot of y'all want to hear about taxes. So let's open that door. Have a lot of specific questions. I want to begin with your views, this question here, your views on the Grover Norquist pledge regarding the tax pledge, that you will under no circumstances raise taxes, that an increasing number of Republicans, and I apologize, I don't know if Robert Hurt has taken that pledge or not.
He has.
Yeah. Your thoughts on that?
Well, first, I'm going to ask everybody in this audience, you know, who the hell's Grover Norquist? You know, I mean, isn't that amazing that some right-wing jerk like him can threaten the very security of this country by going around? And how gullible are these politicians that would sign up to some jerky Washington guy's phony baloney pledge? You don't make pledges to guys like him. You know, your pledge is to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America and the people that it stands for. And that's what our members of Congress should be doing. And, you know, these guys have gotten us, and some women, too, have gotten us into these wars that they didn't pay for, okay, and run up the deficit. And they've kicked the can down the stream, under this Grover Norquist pledge. And you know, these Republicans, they're scared to death to call Grover Norquist names, you know. But, hey, Grover, you want to record this? I don't give a damn if you what you think about me. So, you know, he's going to be against me either way. So, you know, and I just think a pledge to somebody like Grover Norquist is obscene, and you'll never catch me doing that.
So staying with taxes, your thoughts on the tax code? We had a question regarding an effort to simplify that. And also, the question continues, raise sufficient revenue to fund our national priorities. Are we raising, let me start there, are we already raising sufficient revenue to fund our priorities? It's just not being spent on our priorities.
No, we're not. We need to raise more revenue. And, you know, the devil is in the details about how you do it. But we all know that the tax code has gotten so convoluted. And if you're a small business person and you're faced with all these rules and regulations and forms and whatnot, and as a small farmer, I when I do my taxes, I have to do my taxes as a retired general officer, and you know, and then I have to do my farm taxes, and then I had a small consulting business. I was on the boards of some companies, so I had to do that part. And it you know, it gets to the point where you can't do it yourself. You have to hire somebody to do it for you. And that's kind of over the top in my view. And I think I'd like to see a much simpler tax code. And then the other part of it is, and this is where the parties get so out of whack on this. You know, we talk about who should pay more taxes. And we've taxed our middle income families pretty heavily. And we're not at a point right now where I would favor additional taxes for working families. But, you know, people that are making millions and billions of dollars can't afford to pay more, you know. And when you're in one of those jobs, how did you get there? Were you just born into it? Did you work your way up? Are you there because we live in a wonderful country where, you know, you can rise to that level of affluence? And what's wrong with paying back a little bit to your country? And they act like the extra percent or two that they've been asked to put in, some of them do, like it's going to kill their ability to fund small businesses and all of that. And I just think that there are folks who, and you hear this all the time, who say, please tax me more. I'm willing to give more back to my country. And I think it's a shame when you have millions and millionaires and billionaires who are playing less taxes than the secretaries that work for them, as some have come out and said they have. So yeah, we do need tax reform.
Are you advocating for class warfare when you say that?
No, I that's one of those pejorative phrases. I think that's pretty much an irresponsible phrase. We have enough tension in our society today between folks that are struggling to make a living and those that are living in fabulous affluence with multiple houses and multiple cars and vacations all over the world for extended lengths of time and so on. And for the working families of America, and particularly in Virginia, to say, we think some of you should pay a little more, and then label those folks who are advocating some more revenue, but more cuts as well to solve our deficit problem as class warriors, I think is irresponsible. And I think that's the kind of rhetoric that politicians should avoid.
What about corporations in America have let me put it like this. I don't have the ability to show my expenses in one country and my revenue in another country. I wish I did. Mm-hmm. But many corporations in America do, and that is legal, right. And they take advantage of that. And they tend to show their costs in America and their revenue elsewhere. And this has become standard practice.
Well, I'm not a tax accountant, but I will tell you that we all need to recognize the fact we live in a global economy, and global trade is here, and money is going to flow back and forth across borders. But there needs to be some justice in this, and some equity in this, and some fairness in this, and there needs to be government oversight of this, so that we know that the laws of the land are being fulfilled. And I am pretty leery of these secret accounts in foreign countries and, you know, people hiding their incomes so that it's not open, particularly people who are running for office, so that it's open to scrutiny for the public. And but this is a complex problem that is not solved by inflammatory phrases like class warfare and things like that. We need to learn how to live within a global economy and thrive as a nation. And you know, folks, I can tell you, as somebody who served overseas in Asia and in Europe, when I was the commander of U.S. forces over there in the Belgium, Luxembourg, Holland area, a lot of people don't know this, but Belgium is further north than the middle of Canada. So it gets dark real early in the winter. You know, you come to work in the morning and it's dark. It doesn't get light until 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, and then it gets dark again about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And always when I came to work, the lights were on in the American delegation. That was the only place in NATO headquarters where they were on. And when we went home at night, they were always on again. And it always brought home to me what hardworking, good people Americans are. And we're a productive people, and we can compete in the global economy and keep our standard of living high and provide for our people, and that's when we're strongest as a nation. But the world is changing, and we've got to change with it, and we've got to update these tax laws, and we've got to find fairness for our people. We can't go on where the richest segment of our people just get richer and richer and richer every year, and the poor people and the people in the middle class lose ground every year, year and year and year. It's not going to work in a democracy. And so some of these laws and things do need to be revised.
The toughest nut to crack there in this global economy is when you go apples to apples are labor costs. And that, and we all know that's why these jobs are moving over there. That's why the jobs came to Southside in the first place, because there was cheap labor down in Southside, Virginia, and now they're elsewhere in the world. How do American workers compete with somebody who's willing to work for 25 cents a day?
Coy, you need to focus on productivity. You know, just the amount of money you make is one thing, but the productivity is another thing. And American workers are still the most productive in the world. And the underlying element of that is education. If we can get our young people educated and we can keep them competitive in the world, we can, because we have that American ingenuity that people talk about, and we're a hardworking nation. You know, you look at the average number of days per year that American workers work compared to workers in other countries, and you find on an annual basis we're one of the most productive nations in the world. And we need to continue to build on that. But in order to do that, we've got to invest in children starting in pre-kindergarten. We've got to invest in children that want to go into the sciences and technologies. And let me tell you something else, folks. Underpinning all of this is our teachers. We need to value our teachers more. We need to respect them. We need to help them with the struggles they have in our schools, and we need to make sure they're adequately funded. And in some cases, you know, there have been lots of experiences with all different kinds of new school systems, year-round schools and charter schools and so on. We need to look at these experiences and learn from those and spread them as widely as we can among the general population. And there needs to be help for those counties where the tax base is so low that they can't compete with the more wealthy counties. You know, in Fauquier County, where I live, is on the outskirts of the Washington, D.C. area. And a teacher in Fauquier County makes about 30 or 40% less than a teacher in Fairfax. So if you're a young teacher, you want to get in your car and fight the traffic on Route 66, you can go in and get a starting salary at a substantially higher rate than you can if you work out in your home county. Well, you know, over the long haul, that's not going to be good. And the quality of education gradually declines in that poorer county under those conditions. And so there are some roles for the federal government here. And Education is one of my most important topics, not only because it has personal effect on my family and, of course, was the very foundation of my life. If I had not had the support that I had as a youngster to get through high school and the people that gave me an opportunity to work my way through college, I would have never had the life that I've had. So I'm dedicated to making sure that other young people who are willing to work hard have the opportunity for a good education, regardless of their race, their religion, their sex, and where they live.
Well, let's stay with that topic then on education. How do you fix our schools? Schools that were established really under an 18th century model, and it's a factory system, and we churn children out in age groups, in peer groups. There are people who say the problem are the career teachers, the problem are the administrators, the problem is, you know, they get plenty of money and they just waste it. And there's others who say the problem is the fact that you've tied the teachers' hands with increased testing, and nobody in the school, the students don't like it, the teachers don't like it. They might all be right, but what's your view?
Well, you know, I've talked to teachers all over the 5th District because I'm interested in this, and almost everywhere I go, we've done over 300 events like this so far in all 22 counties. I'm looking down here at Katie. I was just over in her county the other night talking to people along these similar lines. And almost everywhere we go, there's a teacher or two in the crowd. And I listen to them, and they have lots of good ideas. And there are problems with the laws now. You know, No Child Left Behind needs to be fixed. There's problems with the way teachers get graded under that. You know, they get graded on these test scores, and they don't get graded on how much progress they made in the year they were teaching that kid. They just get graded on that kid's final scores. So if they're brave enough to take kids that are coming in with low scores, they know it's going to be ever more difficult to get them to that higher level. So they're, instead of grading them on the progress in their tenure, they're grading them on their cumulative progress, which is a problem. We see unfunded mandates where the federal government puts down rules that and then doesn't appropriate any money to support those rules. And as you said, it's an outmoded system. You called it a factory system. It's really a farm system. Our schools were set up to run during the year when the kids weren't needed out in the fields for harvest. And so they were off in the summer to work on the farms, and they had to be off in the afternoon to help mom and dad with the chores around the farm and so on. Most of our kids today come from either single-parent homes or homes where both parents work. So we have millions of children who come home at 2:30, 3, 3:30 in the afternoon. There's nobody at home. TV is there. Games are there. There's nobody to get them to do their homework. And I would like to see school run longer during the day and use those afternoon hours for mentoring, for sports, for all of the things that would help those children develop as little intellectual assets for the future of our country. But we're going to have to invest in that. Virginia is about in the middle of the pack in terms of our per capita pay for teachers. We're certainly not near the top. And there's a long history of the correlation between per capita income and per capita investment in education. And when you lower the per capita investment in education, guess what? A few years later, the per capita income in those states go down. And so we've got leaders right now in Virginia that are absolutely putting us on a downward course, and we need to reverse that and cut spending in other places so we can invest in what is really the future of our country, which is our children. And that includes special needs children like my autistic son. He's 14 years old, and he's a wonderful boy. And someday he wants to be a teacher or a farmer. And he will fulfill that dream because he's smart. He's a very high IQ. He just learns a little differently than other kids. And by the grace of the Lord, I have a wonderful wife who's fought tooth and nail to get that child educated. And as I'm on the stump, I run into mothers all over the 5th District who have children like that. And we need more funding for special education here in Virginia, and I'm going to fight like hell for it when I get in.
I would be remiss if I didn't point out that you just ran into another one. I have a 10-year-old boy with autism as well, and I can certainly relate. While it is not a front-burner issue for those of us in the Charlottesville area, this issue of uranium mining is very important to many voters in the southern part of the district. The 5th District just happens to sit on one of the biggest uranium deposits in the world, and there's one company, at least, that really wants to get in there and get some of that out, but a really orchestrated and powerful grassroots movement is opposing that for a variety of reasons. What is your position on uranium mining in Virginia?
Well, this is the oppose the uranium mine button, vote for John Douglas button right here. So I'm unabashedly opposed to the opening of that mine. We do not need to open that mine in Virginia. I've had, you all know I was Assistant Secretary of the Navy. The Navy's nuclear propulsion program was under my command. Spent a lot of time dealing with nuclear issues. Where does the uranium come from? What do we do after the fuel is spent and so on? And we do not need this uranium mine here in Virginia. I have recently asked my opponent to join with me in a bipartisan effort to create federal legislation that would ban that mine from ever opening near any kind of populated area in Virginia. And I have yet to receive a reply, but I think this is an important area where all of us need to. It goes back to your question about why isn't he here today in a debate, because he knows I'm going to call him out on this issue. He's tried to obscure the fact that as to where he stands on uranium mining. His position has been that he supports the ban for now until there's further studies. Well, that's just a way of kicking this down until after the election is over. And I'm challenging him to come out clearly and say, we've had studies, at all kinds of various levels, and my opponent needs to come out and say clearly in plain, simple English to the people of Virginia, is he for it or is he against it? And if he's against it, I'll join with him in a bipartisan effort to make sure it never happens. If he's for it, then damn it, he ought to be honest enough to all of us to say it in front of us. And I'm hoping that he'll come clean on this. And this thing could be potentially a disaster of the first magnitude for Virginia. I happen to have seen uranium mines in Europe. When I was over there as a general, after the wall came down, I had an opportunity to tour East Germany, and they had a mine that they were mining uranium for the Russians, and it's in an area just like southern Virginia. The topography is about the same, and it was a unmitigated disaster. Cancer rates in the area were skyrocketing. Their livestock were contaminated and over a wide variety of wide area around it, and they've spent over 10 billion with a B euros trying to clean it up, and they don't have it clean now. And what happens to these companies when something gets out of control? They go bankrupt, and then they turn to us and say, okay, you pay for cleaning it up. And this is a case where there is no real need to open that mine. It's absolutely clear. This is probably the clearest example of greed versus good. And by golly, we have to stand up against this mine. And you can count on me to fight like crazy to keep it from ever happening.
Just another reminder: you have an opportunity to ask questions. Just jot them down really quick. Raise them up. And we'll bring them up here. Be happy to read them for you.
By the way, while we're still on that, I want to make sure the other thing my opponent says about uranium, he keeps saying it's a state issue. It's a state issue. Have you all ever heard of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission? Okay, is he trying to say that they don't have any say in this? you know, and there are other, what about the Clean Air and Clean Water Act? Is he trying to say that doesn't apply? I don't know if you all know this, but he voted against trying to say, he voted in Congress to keep the Clean Air and Clean Water Act from applying to uranium mines. That vote's on record. And so, we need to be clear about this. This is a good example of somebody trying to dodge and hide, and now you see it, now you don't, and I won't go to the debate, yada, yada, yada. And so this is one that it's time to come on out and be honest with Virginia on this.
We have a lengthy question regarding support from the from a number of political action committees that are supported by unions. And this question specifically mentions the AFL-CIO, and they put out a candidate questionnaire that you respond to. Can you talk about that and your support that's come from unions? And the question specifically asks, would you be willing to post your answers to those questionnaires that you've been asked to fill out by union groups? I'm assuming, and this question assumes, that there was a questionnaire. I don't know if there was or not.
I'm not sure what they're referring to, but I do get questionnaires from people occasionally, you know, that ask me where I stand on things. And I think you have to look at those case by case. They have this little fine print at the bottom, you know, that says once you fill it out, it's their property. And I don't know if you can release what you did or not. So I'm not sure what the questionnaire is referring to. But I will say this. I am a supporter of, good wages for our people. I think our people have a right to join unions if they want to. The laws are fairly clear about how this works. We know Virginia is a right-to-work state. And I certainly don't have anything to hide on my position there. But whether or not you can release these things, I'd have to ask my campaign or ask the people that sent them to me whether they're publicly releasable.
But when asked about specific legislation,
yeah, sure.
You would answer those questions for these people just like you would on any questionnaire.
Yeah, if there's a specific question, I'd be glad to answer it.
Give us your thoughts regarding, staying on this topic, give us your thoughts regarding collective bargaining on the part of public employees. We saw that in the news. What was it, Wisconsin? That was a big issue there. And Virginia has laws opposed to this kind of thing. And yet this question asks, each year we see in Congress some legislation proposed that would override Virginia's policy. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think public employees in most sectors of public employment should have a right to unions. I don't see a vast difference between most of the services provided by our state and local governments than the services provided by industry. So I support the right of public employees to join unions. Now, there could be some segments of public life where it might not be in the best interests. We don't have unions for military people, for example. I'm not sure that would be too good of an idea. You know, they do in Europe. In some countries, they do. And I'm not sure that would be a good idea. But, you know, for teachers and people that work in state government and so on, why shouldn't they be allowed to join unions? I don't see anything wrong with that.
Virginia made national news regarding that transvaginal ultrasound legislation that was proposed. We saw protests in Richmond. Give us your thoughts now about the rights of women and along these lines, legislation that we often see.
Well, you know, that particular piece of legislation was just shameful. You know, Virginia became the laughing stock of the United States. You know, people on Saturday Night Live were making jokes about us and so on. And the Virginia legislators who voted for that should hang their heads in shame. And, my wife had to take one of those intrusive, painful procedures, not because of she was pregnant, but because of a scare with cervical cancer. And so we know in our family what it's like. And the very idea, the very gall of these people, that just think of a young female soldier coming home from Iraq or Afghanistan and is concerned about whether or not she could pursue her military career and raise a child, being told that because she's a Virginia resident, she has to go through those kinds of procedures to have an abortion here in our state. I mean, this made us not only the laughing stock of the United States, but the laughing stock of the world. And it was a shameful step because it was a punitive thing to try to make it more difficult for those young women that are struggling with probably some of the most difficult decisions in their life. And I can't tell you how saddened and ashamed I was of the Virginia legislature to do that.
Yeah. We have another question regarding the banking industry, and we recently learned, and I don't know all the specifics of it, that some of you are more educated about than I am, but the banks that were operating working together secretly to control the LIBOR rate, and you mentioned earlier about regulations and the role of government in regulating and leveling the playing field in business. Pick up on that and share more views, if you can, regarding banks specifically and lending institutions.
Well, you know, we've gone through an experience here just here in recent, you know, since the collapse back in the around the time of the recent election, where we've seen these banks that are, quote, too big to fail, and we see them making these crazy decisions, and we've seen the regulatory bodies that are supposed to be overseeing these banks not fulfilling their oversight duties. And it's clear to me that we are in a global economy where money is flowing back and forth between the United States and the rest of the world. And this industry needs some regulation, and when we pass laws, those laws need to be enforced, and there needs to be the oversight agencies need to be funded in a way that they can fulfill their oversight responsibilities. One of the things that we have seen in recent years that I think is absolutely deplorable is the Congress will establish requirements for oversight of things like banks, and then they hold that up and say, look what I did. Look what I did. I made these banks. They're going to have to check this, and they have to check that, and have to check that, and so on, make a long list of things. And then when the appropriation bill comes, and the regulatory agency comes in and says, okay, you told us to do all these checks. Now we need some people to go out there and do those checks. And then the same congressmen say, oh, no, that's big government. We're not going to fund that. So the law's on the books and there's no checkers. Well, what good is that, folks? That's like, I mean, how'd you like to get on an airplane and the pilot gets up there in the air and he asks the control tower, I'd like permission to take off to fly to Los Angeles. And what you hear back is a computer program saying, there's no one in a control tower now. The FAA has been defunded by your friendly Republican Congress. Fly there at your own risk. Well, you know, that's what they do to us. And there is a relationship between governance and adequate funding of those agencies that are supposed to do the governance. And we're seeing lots of unfunded mandates right now. And that's another example where Congress is not doing its duty. It's just like this law that we're all looking at right now called sequestration, where if they can't decide, how to take cuts, come the end of the year, there are going to be these massive cuts on the social programs and massive cuts to defense. And instead of telling you what to cut, everything gets cut by the same percentage. And we all know everything's not the same priority. Their job, that's their job as our representatives, is to knuckle down and figure it out. And where are they right now? They're taking their month-long vacation. Of course, Mr. Hurd is so busy on his vacation that he isn't here, so, you know, even though he has nothing to do right now.
I have a couple of questions that are sort of big picture questions about our country. And I just want to get your thoughts. Pull the camera way back. Let's talk about where America is in the world today. Sadly, we have I've seen this. We have a lot of younger people who say that, you know, America's lost its way and we're just not the country we were. And this is going to be the century of China. And China will be the world leader. And they're the ones that are creating jobs and building industry. And they are the ones who are making things. And America no longer makes things. We send trees to China where they make desks. And then we ship them back here and put them in Target. So what are your thoughts now about that view, number one? Is it correct? And number two, if it is, how do we recapture that great American spirit for the 21st century?
Well, it's certainly not a view of America that I believe is an accurate view. We're still a great people with great resources and great ingenuity and great institutions of learning. We are in a world that is rapidly changing, and we're in a world that we have to stay up with the change or we will decline. But we have wonderful resources in this country to do that. We have problems in our education system, but it's still superior to the education systems of many of the countries in the world. We have vast national resources. We haven't talked about energy today, but we could be energy self-sufficient if we would take the time and effort to develop energy programs that would lead us in that direction. We have vast amounts of energy in this country that could be harnessed if we would just move in that direction. And we are moving in that direction. But you know what makes us great as a people? What makes us great as a people is the fact that we have a democracy that's different from almost everywhere else in the world. We're here today. All of you are participating in what I spent my life as a soldier defending. You know, you're here. You can ask me any question you want. I can answer it in any way I want. If I screw up the answer, then make you mad, then you don't vote for me. You know, if I my answers are in line with your thinking, then you will vote for me. But nobody is telling you what to think, and nobody's telling me what to answer back. And, you know, the freedom of thinking that exists in this country, of our young students here at the University of Virginia, for example, when they come here, their freedom to open their minds and learn about philosophy and the world and the history of the world and the history of our country, the good things we did as a nation and the mistakes we made and the way we corrected our mistakes and so on. All of those things lead to a vibrant society. So I am not a pessimist. I believe that this country will remain as a bright, shining example of what a free people can do if we band together. Our biggest worry in this country is this polarization of our parties, this bickering across party lines that exists today, and probably that we've gradually allowed money to become so pervasive in politics, and so the merit of our politicians, the experience of our politicians, their moral values are taking a second seat to money. And I think that's our biggest danger, not some of these other things.
I want to give you an opportunity to talk about energy. You mentioned self-sufficiency.
Yes.
What do we need to do as a nation to make positive changes?
Well, you know, for a variety of reasons, both economic and ecological, we need to get off of petroleum-based energy. And, you know, every time you go and fill up your car with gas or diesel, you're sending a check to Al-Qaeda, whether you know it or not. And most of that stuff is coming from the Middle East. And we have energy here that could move us off of that. For example, I live on a farm. My farm equipment is all diesel-powered. Diesels run on natural gas. I could have a big tank out there at my farm, and I could run my tractors off of natural gas just as well as diesel. T. Boone Pickens told me that if we could get all of our farms across America off of diesel and onto natural gas, we'd be able to cut our oil imports by more than 50%. And we're moving inexorably towards electric control cars for a variety of reasons. And we need to reinvent our cities so that people live closer to where they work. And we need to begin to think of energy as a more precious commodity than we have in the past. But it is achievable. But to achieve it, we have to invest in it. It's not going to come just by, you know, magic. It's going to come step by step. You know, let me tell you a couple of stories that I think are applicable to this. When I was a young officer, we realized that the Russian air defenses were getting to the point where we a regular airplane trying to fly through Russian air defenses was doomed. It had no chance of not being shot down. And so a team of young scientists that I was happy to be associated with were told, see if you can build an airplane that's invisible. And we did. In about 6 or 7 years, we had an airplane called the Stealth Fighter at a secret base out in Nevada. And I had the pleasure of, when I was the director of defense programs at the White House, of taking Ronald Reagan out to that secret base, and I showed him that airplane. And later, I was asked to go to England to explain it to Mrs. Thatcher, because we needed to use her bases in that first raid on Gaddafi. She was the first American ever to know about that airplane, and when she told her scientists about it, they said, oh, the Americans are making it up. It's impossible to build an invisible airplane. And we did. We did it with American engineering and American technology. The other program that I was closely associated with was a Tomahawk cruise missile. And when we started that program, people said, you can't take a 2,000-pound bomb, put little wings on it, and fly it for 2,000 miles and hit a 10-foot target. And we did it. You saw how we used Tomahawks in Iraq and Afghanistan. That, again, is American ingenuity. You talked about our ability to put that new Mars rover on the surface of Mars. If we can do those things, folks, we can be energy sufficient. We just have to put our minds to it and our shoulders to the wheel, and we can get this done. But it takes bipartisan support in the Congress to move in that direction. And we have all the tools we need, and we have all the elements we need here to make it happen. And I'm optimistic that wind can be harnessed. Solar power can be harnessed. We can better harness our rivers and even our tidal fluctuations off the coast. And there's a role for nuclear power stations in the future. All of these things combined can get us off of the kinds of energy that are not only hurting our economy, but are ruining our environment. And it's something we need to begin to do now. I think global warming is a real thing. As a farmer, every year I see bud break on my vines in my vineyard coming earlier and earlier and earlier. And so I see it happening around me, and I think we can do it, and I'm going to be a very strong proponent of moving our country as quickly as we can towards energy independence.
So we've got 15 minutes left. This would be the last call for any questions. If you have them, just write them out, raise them up, and we will pick them up, and because I want to give you an opportunity to close out with some final thoughts as well. I'm just curious, as you travel the 5th District, what you're hearing from people. You knock on doors and sit on porches. And
yeah, I've done over 300 events. And, well, the first thing I will tell you is that the 5th District is a wonderful district. And we have wonderful, God-fearing, hard-working people in this district. But the needs of our district are different from one county to the next. Our most northern counties, the unemployment rate is half the national average. In our most southern counties, it's 2 to 3 times the national average. In some parts of the 5th District, high school graduation rates are below the norm, and the school budgets are being cut even further. I know in Fauquier County, where I live, they had a terrible, acrimonious fight between the Board of Supervisors and the school board over this year's school budget. And they were trying to eliminate sports and trying to eliminate all kinds of extracurricular programs. In many of the counties, the teachers haven't had a pay raise for 3 or 4 years. So those are areas of concern. I hear universal opposition to that uranium mine. Universal operation. The farmers down in the area down there know that if that thing is in, they're eventually going to be out of business. And the benefits of that will accrue to a few people who will make a lot of money off of it, and all the rest of us will be stuck with a bill. So that comes up all over the place. And women's issues come up throughout the district. I think women from very young women who are just in their teenage years to senior citizens realize that what the Virginia legislature has done in the last couple of years is shameful, and they'd like to see that changed as well. So those are some of the common issues I hear.
Just had a question come in regarding your thoughts on fracking.
Well, you know, fracking, to me, what I know about it is, looks to me like a procedure that needs a lot more research. I've seen some documentation of areas where there's a lot of concern that fracking may be related to natural gas getting into the water supply and so on. And we don't need to frack to begin to more fully exploit our natural gas production here. You know, in lots of areas you don't need to do it, but in some areas you do to make it viable. And if we're going to do it, I would like to see more research done before we just open the floodgates and let people frack everywhere. I just think we need to know more about how it operates, and is there a relationship between fracking and pollution of our underground water streams. I'm not sold on it yet, folks.
And earthquakes, too.
That's the other thing, you know, about that uranium mine. You know, we've had, what, 2 earthquakes here in the southern part of the, right in the 5th District. We've had a couple of unexpected storms that put millions of people out of power. We've had hurricanes come through here that have killed, you know, tens and people at a time when we had these micro bursts in certain areas where effusive amounts of rain came down. So, you know, the environmental situation in a sort of semi-tropical area like southern Virginia, where the water table is just below the surface, is not a good place to mine uranium.
Along the same idea of mining, what are your thoughts on mountaintop removal mining?
Well, you know, I love Virginia, and whenever I see a mountain scarred by those bulldozers where they change the whole topography, it pains me. I would hope that we can find ways to get the energy we need without those kinds of procedures.
Yeah. So we have 10 minutes out. I want to give you the last 10 minutes. Take as much as you would like. Any of your thoughts about the campaign and the final message you want to leave with these good people today?
Well, the first thing I guess I'd want to again say is thank you all for coming here. You know, you know, I'm a soldier and a fighter. I'm not a polished politician. So if I've misspoken today in some area, I would ask you to forgive me. Because sometimes I speak directly from my heart, and you know, I don't screen everything I say through some political correctness screen that's been developed for years and years of running for office. I am what I am, and I try to present myself that way. And so if I've flubbed the dub on something today, come up and talk to me about it. You might find that maybe I misspoke. But I am what I am, and you know, I can tell you that when I'm elected to be your congressman, I'm not going to be one of those congressmen that goes up there to Washington and stays up there all the time. I'm going to be out in the district. I'm going to develop various advisory bodies like an education council, a veterans council, a council that will bring, you know, teachers and parents together to keep me informed of what's going on in our schools. I'm going to be a fierce defender of our ecology here in Virginia. And I'm going to have to concentrate some on my family. You know, I have those teenage boys at home. One wants to go to the Naval Academy, and the other one's autistic. So I'm going to spend some time on my farm being a good dad. And I think some of the lessons that we learn in our family life help us as members of Congress. And I want to remind you that, you know, I was not brought into this world in affluence. I was born into a family that didn't have much money. My dad was a chief petty officer in the Navy. And after he got out of the Navy, he went bankrupt and we lost everything we had. And I remember my mother crying when they took the car and our house. And my family moved in with relatives. And so, you know, I know what it's like to be at a point in your life where you don't know where the next meal's coming from. You don't know what to do if you get sick. And those lessons, life lessons, are part of my understanding of the needs of the people in this 5th District. And, you know, folks, right now, families are under attack. Right now, the whole institution of the family is under attack in a variety of ways. And part of what we need to do as an American people is to begin to stand up for what families stand for. And that's why I came up. If you get one of these little things, you'll see that our program, you know, is a program to support families, support parents and students, bring job creators and seekers together, protect retirees and veterans, keep our communities safe, and honor our founders. And that whole program was put together after talking to hundreds and hundreds of people across the 5th District, from Danville all the way up to Fauquier County. And we now have, I think, 6 offices up and running now, a couple more coming up online in the next couple of days. I think we do an office opening on Saturday in Warrenton. We have about a dozen young staffers working for us, so the campaign is really, really getting into gear. Thousands of volunteers are beginning to sign up around the district, so If you have a little spare time and you could come on down. We have an office right here in Charlottesville. It's a campaign office that's a Obama, Kane, Douglas office. And we'd love to have you come down, help us make some calls, get out there and knock on doors, because this is a time when the policies of our government that we've been pursuing for a long time are not sustainable. We can't go on importing the amount of foreign oil that we've been importing. We can't go on and polluting our atmosphere. We can't go on with a budget deficit as high as it is. We can't go on spending $300 million a day in places like Afghanistan, neglecting the needs here at home. We can't go on with the education system that's falling behind the rest of the world. So all of these things need us to pay attention, because change is going to come. And the issue here is that change going to be in the best interest of the working families of Virginia? Or is it going to be in the interest of that little fringe on either side that can fund these super PACs and buy the election? That's what really hangs in the air in this election. So this is the time, if we all get out and stand up for the families of Virginia, we can make a difference. And I would just, again, thank you and carry you back to one phrase that came out in several parts of our questions today. This is a time when we need to ask ourselves, are we being motivated by what's good for the American people and what's good for the 5th District, or are we being motivated by greed? You know, greed is an ugly thing. And when you get to the bottom of some of these things, where people have interests that the decisions they make are going to put money in their pocket or put money in the pocket of their families, that's greed. That's not good. And that's not the way you support a democratic people that have fought all these years to get the freedoms that we have, and that so that we can all be treated equal, regardless of our where we came from, or the color of our skin, or our religion, or whatever it is that people try to find ways to divide us. We're all Americans, and we're all Virginians, and we all bleed red blood, and our sons and daughters that we send off to war that die and are maimed for us are doing it because they want you to have the right to come to places like this and say whatever you want. And for people like me to go to Washington and represent you and fight for what you believe in. And that's what America's about. And I've spent my life as a soldier defending our country. And when I look at the stagnation and the gridlock in Washington today, and I look at the needs of our people, particularly in the southern part of our district, where people want to find a job, they want to graduate from high school, they want to be able to go to a college, but there's not always necessary the means for that to happen, that I know that there's one more mission for me in life. And if the Lord's willing, I'll be your congressman, and you'll never have one that'll fight for you more than me. I can tell you that. So thank you, folks.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.